Last October, prominent historian Niall Ferguson offered a devastating critique of the study of history as it is conducted in most American university history departments. They ignore, he said, important events and topics, like the Civil War, for instance, to focus on increasingly narrow interests, the restaurant habits in New York during the Civil War. And they do so in ways that are moralistic, highly politicized, and of little value to the student. And as a result, students have given up the study of history. Welcome to the After Dinner Scholar. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College. In his speech, Dr. Ferguson quoted 20th century philosopher of history, R.G. Collingwood, who said that the study of history was in essence, quote, an attempt to understand the present by reconstructing its determining conditions, close quote. And thus it has been since the beginning of the writing of history, with the author often called the father of history, the ancient Greek historian Herodotus. In his history, Herodotus tells the story of the war between the Greeks and the invading Persians. The war took place during his lifetime, changing the present in unexpected ways. And his book is, as Collingwood wrote, an attempt to understand the present by reconstructing its determining conditions. At Wyoming Catholic College, history does focus on the important events and topics that formed our civilization, beginning with reading Herodotus with Associate Professor of Humanities, Dr. Virginia Arbery, my guest today on the After Dinner Scholar. Welcome, Dr. Arbery. Homer begins his epic, the Iliad, with "Sing, O Goddess," and tells the story of Achilles set against the background of the Trojan War, whereas Herodotus begins by saying, in a sense, here's my research paper, and tells a sprawling tale of every aspect of the Persian War. Mm-hmm. How and why have we entered such a different world?
Mm. Well, I think we have to consider that the world that Herodotus is in, which is between 485 and 425, is a world in transition from Homeric myth to something that I will call Hellenic skepticism. What Herodotus is doing at the very outset is claiming that he's speaking a showing forth, an apodexis, a showing forth of the things that he's seen that surround the center, which is the Greek world. And the things that he's seen add, as he puts it, color to our understanding of the world. So it's this worldwide concern with Greece at the center. And he begins in his showing forth with story of women who are abducted by Easterners, by Persians or Phoenician sailors, and these women who are abducted. So in the whole scheme of things, as the Persians say, it's not very important what happens to them. But these women seem to echo what is the foreground for Homer's Iliad, which is Helen's taking by Paris of Troy. And so from the get-go, Herodotus disengages himself from the Homeric account and gives us another account, much more rational, not very beautiful, but one that conforms to what he says are the accounts given by the Egyptians. Menelaus is covering up the adultery of his wife, and so they're hiding out, as it were, she and her ladies in Egypt. And this is a much more rational account because, of course, what country would place all of its men and its entire future for the sake of a woman, as Troy did. So things that he can't reconcile with his inquiry, as the word history means in Greek, things that don't conform to his inquiry now become consigned to the, as it were, the dust heap of the poets. Interestingly, as this account unfolds, which, as you say, Jim, is a account of how the Greeks and the Persians came to have a contest, and then the account of who won, or at least who succeeded in driving out the Persians. Interestingly, as the story goes on, we see that the Greeks are tempted, some of them, to become Persian, and some of the Persians are tempted to become Greek. And so there's this interesting play back and forth as barbarian meets Greek. They're the other to each other, and the other becomes more familiar as the contest over life and death, over liberty, occurs.
So is it fair to call Herodotus the father of history, as some have? I mean, what are his concerns and interests as he writes, and how are they like or unlike our own when we delve into history?
Yes, indeed. We have the claim that Cicero makes for the first time when he dubs Herodotus the father of history. We have the claim that modern history is even more distanced from the myths than, say, Herodotus was. That modern history is much more verifiable, researched base, and so on. Herodotus's history is different than ours. It seems to very much engage itself in an inquiry into whether a just outcome can result from very unjust actions. So though, unlike a political philosopher, his inquiry is not into the nature of things, the nature of justice, the nature of the city, the nature of the human being, and so on. Nevertheless, his review of events surrounding this contest between the tiny cities of Greece and the huge empire of Persia, nevertheless, because of fortune, or over and against, and maybe over and above fortune, fate, events turn out to bring the high low and the low high. So at the beginning of Herodotus, what I'm suggesting is there's a moral frame behind the history in a way that makes it different, say, than ours, which want to be objective. Toward the beginning of the history, we see a guard, a bodyguard to the king, who's descended from the son of Heracles of Lydia. We see a bodyguard rise to eminence. It's a very interesting story. I don't know if you want to hear it. It's colorful. It's particularly interesting after dinner if you have a glass of wine, but it's a very interesting story.
Now you've got to tell.
Okay. So this bodyguard is doing his duty guarding Condalus, head of Lydia. And let me establish that this is the background story for the whole conflict. And it shows this idea of justice coming through fortune and circumstance over four generations. But so this bodyguard is doing his job, and the king says, "I want you to see my wife." And, well, fine, I observe your wife. No, I want you to see her. I want you to see her in the all together, as it were. And of course, the bodyguard is scandalized. He says, from ancient times, we've learned from our ancestors that the decency of a woman must be protected, and this is not something I want to breach. And he then is told by his superior, Condalus, "Oh, but you don't understand. I have the most beautiful wife in the world." And so the puzzle is why the king would want to verify what he already claims is the case. And all Herodotus tells us is that the king has become, unfortunately, in love with his wife, which is apparently dangerous. It's one thing to have a wife, it's another thing to be engaged with her in an erotic way. So caught in this trap between doing what's right, not to look upon that which should not be seen, and doing what the king commands him, Condalus obeys. Well, as it turns out, the lady knows that though she's not supposed to detect that she's being watched, she realizes she is. So she is silent through this exposure of her modesty, and the next day she confronts Gyges, which is the name of the bodyguard, and tells him that he has gone too far in obeying her husband, and that he has one choice, either to take her by killing her husband and become the king himself, or his other choice is to die. Once again, poor Gyges is caught in this predicament between two unsavory alternatives, but he chooses killing the husband. So at the beginning, you have this usurpation of power, and then several chapters later, Herodotus will say, and this was the reason why eventually fortune would remedy this unjust usurpation of the throne with a punishment to the succeeding one generations later, Croesus, who has become the descendant of Gyges, the richest man in the world, and who gets it in his head to conquer the most powerful man in the world, Cyrus, head of Persia, because he's misinterpreted, as so many of these tyrants do, an oracle. So, of course, this doesn't end well. He's defeated by Cyrus. He's put in a funeral pyre. That's a very interesting story as well. But there's a kind of justice that comes about that remedies the injustice through fortune, circumstance, fate. These are all ambiguous and somehow related in Herodotus. And again, this pattern is unlike modern history, it seems to me, because Herodotus, though he's scrapped the myths, still holds on to an order which reveres the moral order behind the Greek ethos, and finds it troubling when he looks at the choices that are made by barbarians, either Persian or otherwise.
Jumping way ahead in the narrative, tell us about Leonidas of Sparta and the Battle of Thermopylae.
Right, so we have amazing accounts that really do sound like the Iliad as we proceed. So Xerxes has garnered all of his slaves, and there's pretty much no distinction between a Persian subject and a slave. And the forces Herodotus reports are over 5 million. Well, of course, that's a bloated figure, but in any case, it's formidable compared to the tiny, tiny Greeks. And interestingly, back to your initial question, Herodotus wants to tell us that there are, 1,207 ships. Well, there were 1,200 at Troy. So he has that seven more just to trump in importance this event.
Well, he's very precise about the numbers.
Oh, very. Indeed, Jim. Yeah. So coming with this incredible force after crossing the Hellespont, which is a disastrous event for Xerxes, but a kind of an irrational reaction on his part when his ships get torn to splinters by a storm, and then he has his men thrash the river, the ocean rather, between Asia and Greece, and put shackles into it, and then he beheads all the engineers who made the bridge between the two orders. But anyway, he comes in, this man who's trying to fulfill his father's vow to get Athens. You know, every night at dinner, Darius would have one servant announce three times, you must conquer Athens, because Athens had humiliated him at Marathon, the great battle of Marathon, led by Miltiades. So Xerxes, after some deliberation, decides to fulfill his father's vengeance and goes in with enormous forces. And they're headed toward this little pass in Theban territory, Boeotian territory, north of Athens. The Spartans know that they've been betrayed by an area, Theban, and the Persians have a secret pass, the Anapaea Pass, to come in and attack them while the Spartans are sitting ducks. And Leonidas, this stellar figure in Spartan history and glory, sends away everybody else, except some Thebans who he'd like to eliminate because he has it in for them, rightly so. But 300 Spartiates, the best of the best, the real Spartans, not their slave helots, not any of their allies, just those Spartans elect to stay. And they're pummeled with the ridge of the mountain pass over them. They're pummeled for hours, but they sustain an amazing resistance, 300 against thousands of Persians. And keep in mind that these men have never seen Persians before. It was the Athenians at Marathon 10 years before. And you see a Persian who's wearing pantaloons and his hair wrapped in several layers, covered by a turban, and these strange curved swords and everything. It's like seeing people landing from Mars. This is an unusual experience for the Spartans. But they maintain their traditionally revered military discipline. I think there's only one who lives, and he's scorned for having lived. It's an interesting story, has to regain his honor much later. And Leonidas stands with those 300 till the end. And later, the poet Simonides will put a plaque there saying, you know, look upon us, ye who see us. We are the Spartans who loved our law, our aramatra, our law, more than we loved our lives. It's a great testament to the Greek love of liberty and what Xerxes is up against, which he doesn't understand. Hmm.
Well, just real briefly, how do students respond to Herodotus, and how can that help our listeners if they want to read these amazing tales?
This is the best story time around the table with your family. Well, the children have to be a little bit older, but our students at first are overwhelmed by the detail. You know, they almost read the whole book. There, I have to leave out a few things so we can get on to Thucydides, another massive work which continues the tale of what happens when Sparta and Athens go at each other's throats. But honestly, it is. It's better than fairy tale time. Who doesn't find the Egyptians fascinating? They're at one pole of this discussion. They're the stable ones, the ones who never change. They're the ones who do everything the opposite from what the Greeks do. They're the ones who shave their eyebrows when their cats die for a couple of weeks, and then you know that a cat's died. They have unusual habits, and they're also a kind of standard for lawmaking, both for the Spartans and the Athenians. Both Lycurgus and Solon get different aspects of the law. And indeed, Herodotus says the Greeks get their gods from the Egyptians. So that's at one pole. And students are fascinated by all these aspects of Egyptian death and so on. And the other pole, of course, are these nomadic, ever-moving, ever unusual in their death practices, quite loose in their marriage practices, interesting in their ability not to be conquered by the Persians because they're always on the move. That's the other experience. So you have absolute stability on one side with the Egyptians, then you have this mobile, barbaric, almost tribal in its organization, a civilization on the other side, and in the middle are the Greeks. So you get this range, this great ethnography, a set of ethnographies displayed before the students, and they love it. The hardest part for them is keeping all those pieces together in order to follow the narrative, which is why this contest between the Greeks and the Persians. But once they begin to see the whole picture, they realize that all the different ethnic descriptions that Herodotus luxuriates it, which gives the work its color. All of them are connected in some essential way to Persian ambitions. Persia tries to conquer every one of them and either succeeds or doesn't, and those battles between those barbaric forces and the Persian forces are the great backdrop for Athens. Because when you see what Persia's up against when they try to capture the Scythians and the Egyptians and so on, then you get a perspective on how amazing the Greeks are for having conquered, for having defended themselves against the Persian aim to conquer them.
Well, good. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed speaking about it.
Herodotus wrote in his preface to the history, quote, "May the great and wonderful deeds, some brought forth by the Greeks, others by the barbarians, not go unsung, as well as the causes that led them to make war on each other," close quote. The study of history, beginning with the study of Herodotus, gives us the big picture of who we are and where we're going, because it makes us aware of where we've come from. Citing the musical Hamilton, Niall Ferguson notes at the end of his lecture, quote, "History has its eyes on us, even if we do not have our eyes sufficiently on it," close quote. I take that as something of a challenge. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.